Welcome to the special report. I'm Brendan Palu. On the line with me right now is the Honorable Minister of Indigenous Services for the federal government, Mark Miller. Mark, how are you today?
I'm good, Brendan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Mark, first questions first. We are 6 months into the COVID-19 pandemic here in Canada. As of Thursday, we had 564 cases were confirmed among the Indigenous population of COVID-19, with over 110 of those in BC. What's the game plan heading into the fall and winter to protect those who may live either rurally or on reserve?
Well, look, this is an excellent question, and to give you a concise answer and a certain answer would be presumptuous, given that we still have a lot to learn about how COVID spreads and its impact on communities. Clearly, the first wave was one where we saw Indigenous communities, particularly on reserve and remote communities, really rally and put into place a very, very successful model of stamping out the spread of COVID, a system of tracking and tracing, in some cases shutting down communities, which is an exceedingly difficult thing to do. But that came at a cost. And what we've seen throughout the last 6 months, while the federal government and provincial governments moved to support those communities in their own decision-making and respecting that decision-making, is the most successful communities are ones that have really adhered to their health protocols and made sure their communication with the communities inside the community with their members was seamless, so that people could observe very basic hygiene protocols. And then when a case occurred, that tracking and tracing and isolation was done promptly so as to stamp it out. And even in those ones where we've seen a significant spread initially with cases, the capacity of communities to be resilient and deploy those methods has been very remarkable, to the point where, we're cautious when we say this because we're very conscious, and I'm very worried of a second wave. Indigenous communities have fared somewhat better than non-Indigenous communities. But this is the result of their extreme vigilance. And what concerns me in the last couple of weeks is really the uptick that we see in the rest of Canada, and the real threat to Indigenous communities of seeing this spread within their communities, which, no surprise to you and your listeners, are much more vulnerable in terms of socioeconomic disparities and social determinants of health, and correspondingly make people more vulnerable to COVID if and when it rears its ugly head. And I am concerned, as Minister of Indigenous Services and as a Canadian, about the potential impact of a second wave or little spikes here and there. And what we see in the last little while is clusters appearing that denote, and without judging, a drop in vigilance, because economies are opening and we're moving from more of a hammer approach to more surgical risk management approach into managing COVID, because we know we're in it for the long run until such time as an effective vaccine is deployed, and that isn't something that is going to happen in the very near future.
How closely are you monitoring the situation in BC? We've had outbreaks in Haida Gwaii, Squamish, Powell River, and Fort St. James, just to name a few. Are there concerns some of these communities are easing up on restrictions too soon?
Well, look, it's very hard for me to ask communities to do what non-Indigenous communities are doing. It is really something that we work with on a case-by-case basis with communities. Obviously, provinces have opened up. The First Nations Health Authority is really an exemplary body that works quite hard to assess and adjust and adapt to needs as they show up. And obviously, COVID being top of mind, this is something that we are constantly monitoring and working with communities to ensure that their members are safe. We've announced recently a number of funds to make sure that people are able to go back to school safely. People are able to, if they choose, have enhanced vigilance at their reserve in terms of putting up checkpoints, and then other supports. Obviously, mental health, and I read the report recently coming out of British Columbia about the impact of mental health, and particularly the opioid crisis, how it's disproportionately impacting Indigenous communities, and that is something that I'm very preoccupied by, because it is something that's very much a hidden second epidemic in terms of how mental health has impacted communities, and the acute expressions of which include substance use and abuse, and other forms of mental health distress. So it's something to keep monitoring and keep working with communities on. And part and parcel of that is just making sure we have that line of communication and that we keep deploying and tailoring needs and resources, and yes, financial and physical, including enhanced support to northern and remote communities. You mentioned that in the introduction, but one of the things that we put in place at Indigenous Services Canada was a system of charters to ensure that nurses and health officials get into communities and don't they themselves become vectors of transmission. So it is very much something that we keep monitoring and we'll keep deploying so long as COVID is still around.
Now, last month, Ottawa provided an additional $112 million to support a safe return to class for First Nations elementary and secondary school students. To support a safe return to class, what unique challenges do Indigenous students face compared to their counterparts?
Well, I think one of the most acute expressions of that is the state of vulnerabilities in some communities, and that gap in the socioeconomic gap that exists between Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities. So, obviously, access to the healthcare system, access to education, which often doesn't necessarily happen on reserve. And so that $112 million was tailored to really deal with schooling on reserve. But there are students that go off reserve, and you don't want them, much like health personnel and nurses in particular, to become vectors of transmission. So there may be a particular need within a community to shut down again, and those students need support. Obviously, issues of connectivity, work from home, supports in crowded conditions are ones that are uniquely acute in Indigenous communities, and it's something that Indigenous Services Canada will keep working on and working with communities directly, but also through First Nations Health Authority to make sure that those needs are met. And one of the challenges of our government in the past few years has been to really close that education gap. We have been able to do so on a financial basis, but there is much more work to be done in ensuring that resources are there, and in this case, resources to combat a virus that we don't fully understand yet.
Is there a fear that graduation rates among First Nations or Indigenous youth due to a lack of distance or remote learning options in some provinces might see a dip?
Absolutely. It is something that as we know, when at least from our experience, our limited experience in self-governing education systems, we know that Indigenous people graduate at the same or even a higher rate when they are given control over their education, and a painful history with education as administered by the churches and the Canadian government is one that is still top of mind. And so, there are worries with respect to how having to do work from home, particularly when there are issues of connectivity, would impact graduation rates. I think, to some extent, a lot of parents feel that that this last year has kind of been at the expense of their children as they study from home. Children are very resilient, but it's something they have to keep monitoring, particularly not only their graduation, their potential to thrive in what is what I believe the best country in the world, but also mental health challenges as kids are stuck in homes or not able to get out and not able to socialize as they once were. Socialization is a very important part of human nature, and when you're not able to do that, it has an effect that is not necessarily measurable in the short term, but has effects over the medium and long term.
Next question I have for you, Mark. I guess speak to the $305 million in federal funding to support Indigenous communities impacted by the pandemic. How can that be accessed, and what can it be used for?
If you recall, in April, we deployed $305 million into communities in a very rapid fashion, knowing that communities needed the financial backing of the Government of Canada according to their terms and according to the maximum amount of flexibility available. And during the course of the summer, we deployed resources for surge capacity, et cetera. But we did get some feedback from those communities saying, this was a good fund, but we need more of it. And so we went back and got another $305 million that will be deployed in the coming weeks. But we did hear criticism that it wasn't necessarily tailored to specific needs. And knowing that COVID sort of rears its head in different ways and different fashions, we have taken the decision to deploy money is based, essentially the initial deployment of funds was based on factors, most of which were population-based, but also community wellness and remoteness. But the second wave that will be deployed much in the same fashion has a component that will also be demand-based, where communities can apply in a very simple fashion to the regional offices for funds should they need them, knowing that the needs may be disproportionate in certain communities and less important in others.
Now, this is not the only public health emergency taking place in Canada right now. We also have the illicit drug crisis, where in places like BC are seeing a record monthly amount of overdose deaths. First Nations Health Authority reported a 93% spike in deaths during the first 5 months of this year in our province. Are we seeing similar increases across the country, and how concerning is that? And what needs to change, in your opinion?
Your listeners will be very familiar with the opioid crisis, but it is we are seeing this across Canada. It is why we announced $82.5 million specifically to address mental health and to bolster harm reduction models. This is something that is key because it keeps people alive, and we know that people need support when they are in that moment of distress. It is quite acute. Mental health expresses itself in many ways, and it's in most acute fashion. Ideation and suicide, and obviously the opioid crisis is a huge factor in that. And you know, making sure that we deploy those resources in a fashion that reflects cultural sensitivity is important, but also the sheer numbers are important as well. And that is why in the last couple of weeks, the Indigenous Services Canada did move to allocate $82.5 million specifically to mental health. It is something that we will not be able necessarily to measure for a long time, because we know the impacts can express themselves over time. But it is something that we are very aware of. It is very much the hidden epidemic, and we keep seeing it in various fashions. The report out of BC that came out showed that impact on Indigenous people disproportionately of the opioid crisis. But we're also seeing rates of distress go up. Not only, you know, I see it financially in terms of the demands that are made on Indigenous Services Canada for mental health support generally, but we are seeing it across Canada indeed.
Yeah. What additional barriers does the Indigenous demographic face when it comes to mental health, Mark?
A number of elements: historical trauma, the legacy of colonialism, its direct impact, loss of language and culture, all these elements, abuse that you see, that disproportionate socioeconomic development, the United Nations recently came out with a report that looked at the disparities, and while that gap has closed between sort of Canada and Indigenous peoples, it is still a gap that is very, very much acute, particularly so on reserve. Half of that gap is accountable, according to the report that I'm citing, to health, and the other half to education and income. But half being allotted to health is something that is very much top of mind. Part of that is mental health, the results that I described earlier, and then acts very much and skeptical approaches legitimate to traditional mental health ways of dealing with trauma. And that is something why it's important to respect the knowledge on the ground of what suits communities best for how they deal with these things.
A last question I have for you. Let's talk about the reconciliation agreements made between all levels of government on Friday. Lake Babine Nation had signed on the dotted line, and the details of the Wet'suwet'en agreement were made official earlier this summer, I do believe. What are the basis of these agreements, and why is it crucial to do this?
Canada has been complicit in some part to the destruction of the traditional models of governance, and the Indian Act imposed system has not met with unanimity, far from it. And the treaties that we signed, the 11 treaties that we signed, the number treaties, as well as the ones that are much older on the East Coast, have not been respected throughout our history. We are facing a very acute expression of that in Eastern Canada with the Peace and Friendship treaties from the 1760s and the fishing rights. And that should be no surprise to your listeners with more recent agreements that have not necessarily been respected, or at least fleshed out to give Indigenous peoples rights that exist under those treaties. The rights and recognition agreements are an expression of Canada's desire to move away from the Indian Act. And I think what we've learned as a government over the last 5 years is we need to do it on the terms that are told to us by Indigenous communities. And so that tailor-made approach, while it can take time and can take, I guess, a turning of minds that is, you know, we are sometimes resistant to it, it is very important to take the time to do it properly. The agreement with the Wet'suwet'en is something that, you know, it should have been done in the mid-90s, and it wasn't. The Supreme Court told us to do it, and we didn't. It took a crisis to get everyone to the table, and we were very much at the beginning of it. But that, what I believe to be a historic agreement that sets forth a timeline to recognizing rights over thousands of square kilometers is something that is important going forward, as we recognize people's rights to the land that they agreed to share with us. And with respect to Lake Babine, much the same. Everyone knows that the Indian Act model is not ideal, far from it. It's still very much a colonial and discriminatory piece of legislation, despite all the changes that have been made. But it's gonna take time to get out of it, and there isn't one size that fits all. And I think some of the frustration people feel at how slowly these things go sometimes don't reflect the reality of the work that needs to be done to make sure that we advance those rights and respect those rights in a good way.
How has your life changed since the pandemic?
Look, I accepted I was only a minister for 2 months before the support for the Wet'suwet'en demonstrations broke out across Canada, and a month later, COVID. So I agreed to serve as Minister of Indigenous Services in a department that is used to its share of crises and needs work in reforming. So it was a tall task to begin with, and it only got compounded by that. My sole focus is keeping people healthy and alive and deploying the resources necessary for communities to take the decisions that they know best how to take faced with historic pandemic. It is very much a day at a time with a step back once in a while to plan and make sure that we're doing things in the right way, not really knowing what the outcome may be. But so far, people have been able to, there are tragedies around the country, but communities have been exceedingly diligent in making sure their people are safe. And I think there's that, frankly, I tell my colleagues in cabinet that there's something to be learned about how communities react and take Indigenous communities react and take these issues quite seriously. Whereas, I'm MP from downtown Montreal and people are out on the streets. So that is something we can all learn from. But to answer your question, I spend a lot of time social distancing, but I have a lot of time at home worrying about my own children, but also on essentially alert mode with my colleagues in cabinet that are focused on keeping Canadians safe and making sure that no one's left behind.
All right, Mark, well, thank you very much for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to speak with me on this today, and good luck with everything in the future.